Hello, I'm Claire Armitstead. Before you get started with this edition of the Books Podcast, we want to point you in the direction of our sponsor, Squarespace. For everything you need to set your website apart, head to squarespace.com/guardian to get 10% off your first purchase. And now, on with the show.
The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Books Podcast. We'll be having a chat with the American philosopher and cognitive scientist Daniel Dennett, who came in to talk to Richard Lee. Richard, this is someone you've been interested in talking to for a long time, isn't it? What's so special about him?
Well, he's a massive figure in the philosophy of mind. I mean, ever since he first tried to offer an account of how our brains work in his provocatively titled book Consciousness Explained. And he returns to that subject again 25 years later with From Bacteria to Bach and Back Again. And it's full of some slightly wacky ideas, but it's always worth bearing in mind that he's actually in the game of trying to explain things rather than to make them more mysterious.
Ah, stay with us. More of that a bit later. But this week on the Guardian Books website, we've been anniversary-tastic with pieces about the centenary of the poet Robert Lowell, the 40th anniversary of the comic 2000 AD. But we're going to start with a guessing game. Which centenarian is the author of this novel, read here by Tom Hollander for Audible?
What's it going to be then, eh? There was me, that is Alex, and my three droogs, that is Pete, Georgie, and Dim, Dim being really dim. And we sat in the Corova milk bar, making up our Razadox what to do with the evening. A flip, dark, chill winter bastard, though dry.
Yes, for those of you who haven't already guessed, that was the opening of Anthony Burgess's A Clockwork Orange, and we'll hear more of it at the end of the podcast. But though it's undoubtedly his most celebrated novel, it isn't, in my view, his best opening. I'm going to ask Robert McCrum to read it out for us.
The first time I read this, I read it in TypeScript. Now I'm holding a bound copy, but I'll come back to that story in a minute. And the reading goes as follows. It was the afternoon of my 81st birthday, and I was in bed with my catamite when Ali announced that the Archbishop had come to see me.
I like the way you spit out that word, catamite. And I'm going to now immediately ask Sian, who's a bit younger than the other two of us, do you even know what catamite is?
I do now. When you tell me about the first line, because every single time you look up this particular book by Anthony Burgess, everyone always talks about that first line. And so when I looked it up, I had to Google what that word meant. For any other millennials listening, it is something akin to what we would call a bottom.
I brought in, because you're so ignorant, I brought you in my first edition of Earthly Powers, and I have got a first edition of Earthly Powers, although I was rather disappointed to find that it's only valued at £21, which, Robert, is really a sign of how much his stock has fallen at the moment.
Well,
isn't it
hasn't, yes and no. I mean, I think in some ways his stock has survived surprisingly well. If you put money on him, well, he died in 2005, I think. If you'd said to me then what was his future, I would have said his future was murky. And actually, he's done very well. And he's remembered for Clockwork Orange, he's remembered for Earthly Powers. The Burgess Foundation supports his work all over the world. And he's doing, and there's been a Radio 3 series this week. You know, he's a composer, he's a poet, he's a screenwriter, he's a novelist, he writes stories. He was a great reviewer for the Observer. You know, he did lots of things. And he's a man of letters. And he's a great figure, actually. I knew him quite well because my first job years and years ago in 1979 when I was editorial director of Faber and Faber, and I was actually offered this book. And the last time I saw this book was in TypeScript, and it had been offered to me by his then agent, who was a combination of his wife and a man called Gabriele Pantucci, who was an Italian literary agent. And they were out to raise money for Anthony. He lived like a prince, mainly in hotels. He also lived in Monte Carlo, so he had very high costs. He liked to raise money for what he'd written. And this book was a book, you know, as you can tell from that first line, he's really out to please a big audience.
Well, it's a big book, isn't it? It's a brick of a book.
It's a big book. And he wanted, so we offered what in those days was an incredible advance of £50,000. I had to persuade the board to back £50,000. And I was fingers crossed, and Gabriele Pantucci was slavering to sell it. And then Hutchinson, I think, who did it, paid 75 or 65 or something and more, and he went for that, of course. And then later that year it was up for the Booker Prize, and it was head to head in the final between him and William Golding's
The Inheritors, was it?
No, it was Rites of Passage. And Rites of Passage 1, and Burgess threw a huge hissy fit, went back to Monaco, and he was very unhappy. And he was a tremendous character, very turbulent.
He was a bit of a hack like us, Robert, wasn't
he? Yeah,
he wrote
his pen was his source of income.
Is it true that he used to be able to review a book the day it arrived in the post?
There's a famous story where he was the Observer's chief reviewer, and there's a story of they wrote to him saying, would he review such and such? And they also wrote to somebody else saying, would they review a book of Chinese history? And Burgess said, yes, he would. And the review came back before the book, which had been misdirected, had come back. The book was sent to the wrong person, so he reviewed the book without having read it. And the review arrived in the office, and they all howled with laughter, and that was Burgess.
But he also reviewed his own book once, didn't he?
under an assumed name, and then got fired for it. He reviewed his own book and trashed it. So he was a tremendous character. He was a sort of charlatan of genius. I mean, he's a great man. I think he's a great writer. I don't think this book is his best book, actually.
Oh, see, I disagree with that. I think it is. I think it would be one of my Desert Island 100 or something.
Really?
Not six.
You know, I must reread it, actually. But I think it's sort of, there's something about it which is totally fake to me. It's a confection. It's a contrivance. Whereas, going back to Golding, Rites of Passage is a deeply felt, serious book about all the things that book's about. But this is a book which is, you know, from that first line, he's trying to grab the audience. He's trying to hook you in with his brilliance. And it's a brilliant performance. But it's curiously lacking in, I think, deep feeling.
Sian, what does he mean to your generation?
Well, I think particularly for youngins of my generation, it tends to be Clockwork Orange when you talk about Burgess. And it tends to always be linked to the film. I sort of, when I was 18, I started working in a bookstore, and I had a year of very intense catch up with lots of books that I felt I should have read, starting to work in a bookshop, and A Clockwork Orange was one of them, and it has always stuck with me because I think it might actually be the first book that I ever read that depicted rape. I remember it really, really, truly haunted me for quite a while. It was a very intense year of reading because I read American Psycho that year as well.
You see, that's why I would say it's a better book, because it goes deeper into the human condition.
Mm.
This book doesn't. This is designed to. This is entertainment. It's a wonderful entertainment. But it's not. It's much closer to his deepest feelings. I think it's a more important book, actually.
I mean, you chose it.
I did for my list. Yes.
Yeah, it's
for your 100 best novels list. Sian, I'll just bring you back to it now, because we're doing it for the reading group, the Guardian Reading Group, which is Sam Jordison's monthly column, where he does a series of columns and all the readers pile in. And they're actually choosing a book at the moment, so maybe they will make this decision. And they're going my way, Robert. They're going towards Earthly Powers at the moment.
This is in some ways more diverting. Clockwork Orange is quite a hard read, isn't it?
Mm.
I mean, you have to get into the idiom.
Yes, and also getting in the head of a character like that, it's quite an unpleasant experience.
It is, after all, a dystopia, isn't it?
So, I mean, well, that's a funny thing. I always forget that every single time, and then when you sort of go back and look at it, you go, oh, yeah, this wasn't intended as a sort of.
And it was inspired by his experiences in World War II. So it goes back, you know, it's not George Orwell, it's going even further back. It's going back to the dark times of World War II. And the language, obviously, is Soviet Russia, but it's an unsettling and not enjoyable book. Whereas that, obviously, Earthly Powers is a fantastic romp.
So what are the reading groups saying, Sian?
Well, it's quite funny. There's quite a lot of snobbery about doing A Clockwork Orange. People seem a little bit reticent to do that one, I think because it's popular and because it's well known. So there have been a lot of votes for Earthly Powers, and also Dead Man in Deptford, which I hadn't actually heard of.
Which is terrific. The Marlowe. Yeah, it's great. He could do anything, Burgess.
About the playwright Marlowe.
Marlowe, yes.
Who was murdered in Deptford.
Yes, and he's also did a book called Nothing Like the Sun, which is about Shakespeare, which is a terrific book. And, you know, the thing about him was he was an autodidact. He was self-taught. And so if he taught himself about Elizabeth England, he then go off and write a novel about it. So The Man at Deptford is actually terrific.
Oh, good.
It's a very good account of, because the murder of Christopher Marlowe is a sort of sensational. It's never been made into a film. It would make a terrific film. And he, you know, it's perfect material because it's got terrific language, which he loved. He was a great player with words and a great stylist. He had an incredible ear for language. So I think, you know, I think he's a truly great writer, actually.
But a charlatan.
Well, I think there's a side of him. I think, I mean that in the most, you know, most generous sense. I think there was something sort of made up about him, which I can't really, I mean, I didn't know him at all well, but he was tremendously fun to be with. But you sort of thought, there's a kind of, he's very theatrical in manner, like it was all for show. And then occasionally you try and get beyond the show, and then you discover that actually he didn't know as much as he said he did about something, or that he was covering it over. And as you were saying, Claire, there's sort of something, it's air of hackery about you.
So you chose A Clockwork Orange as one of your 100 best novels. And you're now in the middle of the 100 best non-fiction books of all time, for which your next choice is Edward Lear, which has really surprised me, because there's a weird thing about poetry. Is it fiction or non-fiction? Well, it is fictional, obviously.
The thing is, it's categorised in bookshops and it's non-fiction, as you'll remember. Mm. Poetry is non-fiction. Because it's not imaginative, it's a process of expressing one's inner self, but that's a truthful, it's a realistic process, and it's an account of one's inner dialogues, so to speak, and so it counts as non-fiction. So Lear is non-fiction, Edward Lear.
And how far are you through this?
So he's 54.
You're 54 into it.
So I'm just over the hump.
And there are no women now, are there? From now on, it's downhill for women.
There aren't many, but I've found a few. I was just saying, in a couple of weeks' time, I can't reveal. She's a great woman.
Because that was one of the criticisms of the 100 of the many criticisms best novels, wasn't it?
Yeah. I've done my best. But the problem is that when you go back into the past, women didn't write as much as they do now.
You had a really good cracking run of women at the start of the nonfiction, because you're going back chronologically.
Yeah, I had lots.
Yeah, and there's fantastic women. Like, there's like the three in a row, I think, at one point, and I was like, this is doing much better than the novels. Yeah,
the novel... also, I ran out of space. I learned from the novel, because I learned that you could mortgage the space. And so I'd mortgaged the space too badly, so that when I came to, in fact, do the last 20 of the novels, I had no space left to get...
What do you mean mortgage the space?
I mean, it was I'd squandered it.
Ah, you mean you were being a bit sort of naughty and mischievous, of Anthony Burgess-like in your choices?
Yeah, what I'd done is I'd given too many slots away. I gave too many slots away.
I know, there was one year when you had three different novels.
Yeah, and I had too many Edwardians, who are essentially not very important.
After you finish your non-fiction, we'll have to have the real true list. I've had a chance to think of it.
The true list is probably about 30, actually. when you get down to it, when you get really, really down to it, you know. I mean, for example, I've just done The Origin of Species, which is a truly great book. How can you compare The Origin of Species to anything published in the last...
To Edward Lear?
Or indeed anything in the last 30 years. Richard Dawkins, Tom Wolfe. The Origin of Species is a world-class great book, and that deserves to be on any list. But so that's the problem of these lists, is that you're ending up comparing unlike with unlike, really.
But they're sort of about starting a debate, aren't they?
Yeah, about debates, yeah.
You can catch up with Robert's best novels and his 100 best non-fiction columns on theguardian.com. And that's also the place to head to for our book group, where Sam Jordison will be leading the discussion as usual with weekly columns and a live web chat over the next month.
This Guardian podcast is sponsored by Squarespace. To find out more about how to set your website apart, head to squarespace.com/guardian.
And now, as promised, to the philosopher Daniel Dennett, who unravels the mysteries of consciousness with Richard Lee.
So you've spent half a century, your entire academic life, trying to defeat that idea that mind and matter are made of different stuff. Why is that such a hard idea to knock down?
I think it's hard because people have a hard time imagining how a machine with a trillion moving parts can do anything.
Because a trillion is just such a big number.
It's just such a big number. And so they hugely underestimate the power of the brain. And also, they have their amour propre, their egotism. Their love of themselves is bound up with the idea that they're beyond science. There's something
ineffable.
Ineffable and invulnerable to the nasty probings of science.
And so that it's something that's going to... It feels different on the inside as well, doesn't it?
It certainly seems as if we have a wonderful show going on inside our heads that we alone are privileged to enjoy, and that it's done in a medium which is just not like any other physical medium.
So how is it that we get from the kind of uncomprehending expertise that allows a bird to build a nest or a termite to build an elaborate colony? How do we get from that kind of, as you call it, competence without comprehension to the experience of thinking and feeling that we all share?
I think the difference lies not in the material. Brains are made, termite brains and human brains are made of the same kinds of cells, but in the organization, and in more particularly in the functions that are made available. And in the human brain, a lot of those functions, I say in a renegade fashion, this is not the view of most, that a lot of the important functional structure of human consciousness is learned, not developed through the genes. We acquire our consciousness in the same way we acquire a natural language. And it installs in our brains a myriad of micro-habits, habits of thought, habits of reaction and reflection. And it's that cloud of competences which sum up to create the illusion that there's a boss in there who is watching the show and reflecting on the wonders of his or her subjective experience.
We're all familiar, perhaps, from the kind of developmental story of seeing children gradually come to expertise in language, to self-awareness. But how does this story work in terms of the species? How does this develop out of creatures that were not doing this?
Well, let's look at our closest living relatives, the chimpanzees. Brains are remarkably similar to human brains. There's not that much difference, and yet there's a profound difference between a chimpanzee mind and a human mind. There's untold trillions of things that any human being can think about that a chimpanzee can't.
They just don't exist for a chimpanzee.
Just not in their world at all. Not that they aren't clever, not that they aren't highly competent, but their world of possibilities is minuscule compared to ours. And I argue that what enlarges our world and creates our capacities of imagination, for instance, is culture and in particular language. It's not that consciousness is just talking to yourself, although that's a very big part of it. And if a human being couldn't talk, didn't talk, didn't have a language, might be a sign language, I think that human being would have a hugely impoverished cognitive architecture. So I think language plays the central role in creating the consciousness we have, and partly because the reason we're conscious the way we are is because we are asked questions about it, and we have to. It's the second person point of view. It's because I can tell you, and you can tell me, and you can ask me, and I can ask you, but what's it like to be you? What's it like to be me? And it's the very capacity to play that game that actually fleshes out our consciousness.
So it's the recursive nature of the linguistic experience that allows us to think about ourselves.
It is, I think, yes.
So where does this come from, though? It's a kind of chicken and egg problem, isn't it? Because if you start with creatures who aren't using language in this way, then you can imagine, you can imagine teaching someone to use language in this way, but if it doesn't exist yet, how does it arrive?
Yeah, exactly. It's a chicken egg problem, and all chicken egg problems, you know, is it A before B or B before A? And the answer is always yes. It's both. We have many examples of these cyclical, mutual codependent co-evolution stories, and that's what we have to tell in this case. It's a little harder because there's very few fossil traces of how culture got going, how language got going, but there's some, and there's an embarrassment of riches. There are more tempting hypotheses out there than we need. The thing is to figure out how to knock down the ones that are superficially tempting and how to think of ways of coming up with predictions that would support the others. I think that's the hardest part of my book, is the sorting through the wonderful constructive battle that's been going on for more than a decade now on the origins of language.
And what's the story then? What's the story that you arrive at?
Well, the story I tell, which draws on many sources, is that in the beginning of this, there were memes, there were proto-words, there were new habits which spread through a sort of proto-human, human population, not for any particular purpose, but just because they could. They were like viruses. They spread like the cold germs. But they were infectious habits, and pretty soon everybody was doing them, and they were just making these sounds. And they didn't know why they were making the sounds, and they didn't have any particular purpose. But those were the ancestors of what eventually evolved into words made up of phonemes, which made for a highly reliable transmission under noisy conditions. And meanings accrued to them, and there was a period when there was no such thing as a noun or a verb, but eventually words settled into useful categories. That's a design process, but it's not intelligent design by human beings. It's a design process by cultural evolution, by the differential reproduction of words. And so Darwin himself noticed the deep parallel between the evolution of language and the evolution of species. And Richard Dawkins, with his concept of memes, pushed it harder, and I picked up where Dawkins left it and ran with that ball. And I think it's close to incontrovertible that language has to have been started first with behaviors that turned out to be so valuable that if you didn't have those behaviors, if you were a slow learner, you were in trouble.
Behaviors warning people or
and
attracting their attention or
and impressing people and dissembling to people and all the other things we can do with language. In the beginning, you didn't have to have a credit card, and there's no law that says you have to have a credit card, but if you don't have a credit card today, you're disabled. And in the beginning, you didn't really have to have language. This is the way evolution always works. There's something which establishes an advantage, and pretty soon it becomes the norm, and if you don't have it, you're at a great disadvantage. So I think there was very powerful selection. Now we're talking about genetic selection of genes to make our brains better word processors. And I'm sure it's much easier for our children to pick up a native language now than it was for our ancestors way back then in the early days when it was hardly even a language.
But you say the process began in the cultural sphere with memes and then has influenced our genes. But a thing like a meme, which can be a way of doing something or a word or maybe a model of something that you can think about, seems such a very different thing from a gene, seems so very various, so in so many different levels and so many different types. Is it really something that can do the theoretical heavy lifting that a gene can?
Oh, I think so. First of all, it's a mistake to think of genes as DNA. Genes are the information that the DNA carries. The DNA is the vehicle. Poems aren't made of ink. Genes aren't made of DNA. They depend on DNA. That's the fundamental medium of genes, but it's not the only one.
And the fact that there isn't one fundamental medium for memes is of no importance.
It's of no importance, and just for a sort of curious perspective, back in the earliest days of life, there may have been competing systems of replicators. To some extent, there was. There was RNA replication, and then things sort of settled in on DNA replication. That's a complicated story. But the point is that now there is sort of one canonical language for almost all gene transmission and reading for making life. Well, in the land of memes, memes are very recent things. They've only been around for maybe a few hundred thousand years. And maybe we're on the edge of creating the canonical medium, and it's called HTML. If a poet wants to get her poems really secure in the culture, better get them online because that's the most fecund medium of reproduction today.
And so then the same would apply to a gesture or to a fashion. Get it online.
Absolutely, yes.
What is it exactly that the meme offers to cultural studies over and above what cultural studies has already got?
One of the, I think, blind spots in cultural studies is that it tends to be over-psychological in a certain way. It's ideas that are spread. Well, but a lot of things that happen in culture aren't really ideas. The change in the pronunciation of a word, the change in the meaning of a word. where terrific used to mean terrifying and incredible used to mean unbelievable, the words changed their meaning and their sometimes their pronunciation by an imperceptible shift in the population of examples, just like evolution. And to call it an idea, as it were, puts it in consciousness as a focal thing, when in fact it happens without you even noticing it. So if you want to say, well, we already have ideas, in fact, we have unconscious ideas that nobody even notices, well, why don't you call them something that's a little more useful and call them memes?
I guess it's also that thought that culture is within the space of ideas that makes the chicken and egg problem of where did it come from so very difficult to imagine.
That's right. If you are convinced at the outset that human culture is just standalone, hanging in midair like a skyhook, with no antecedents in biology, then you're bound to find mystery. But wake up, you know, we're living in the Darwinian age, and there are no skyhooks.
Does some of this resistance that you encounter to this idea, particularly this idea of memes, does it come from the fact that it's such a gradual process and that conceiving of a gradual process taking place over a long time is just hard?
Well, I think a lot of the, I think you're right, that's one of the sources of resistance. It's just hard to imagine. But another is the tendency of people to have a rather short-sighted view of human culture and to think of contemporary culture as the model. Well, contemporary culture is nowhere near as Darwinian as early culture was. Cultural evolution has itself evolved. That's one of the main themes of the book. So that as culture produces more and more memes, more and more thinking tools, and thinking tools based on thinking tools, and thinking tools based on thinking tools, gradually we created, or we didn't create, nature created intelligent designers, brilliant poets and architects and scientists, mathematicians and the like. And so when people look out and say, oh, look, all the great, wonderful designs in culture are the products of human genius. That seems to be profoundly un-Darwinian. But in fact, that's a perspectival error. Even the geniuses, how do you make a genius? There has to be a gradual process which gets you from bacteria to Bach. And Bach had a mind that was beautifully equipped with all the latest thinking tools that were available to him, and he put them to very great use. But even Bach, he wasn't a miraculous genius. He had a very idiosyncratic and unique genius, but it has to ultimately have been composed of myriad dispositions to act, to think, that work together to produce stunning results.
And were part of the culture from which he came.
Exactly.
Is it also one of the sort of argumentative strategies? Is it also that if you're arguing for a gradual change from here to over there, then anybody who opposes this idea of gradual change can pick any bit that they feel is implausible and say, but what about this bit?
Yes. And in fact, ever since Darwin, Darwin critics and doubters have tried to find something of which they can say and prove you can't get here from there. You know, there's just no trajectory through gradual Darwinian mechanisms to get to this wonderful thing. I call such a thing, if there were, and I call it a skyhook. It's a miraculous, self-sustaining, it just hangs in the air there without any support. But of course, there are no skyhooks, but there are cranes. And they're non-miraculous, but you have to build them, and they have to be standing on the ground.
And you then have to come up with a convincing story of how it might be built as well.
Yeah. But then when you have cranes, can have cranes that can lift other cranes into existence, and you can get a cascade of cranes, and that's how we get to Bach and Einstein and Jane Austen and the other great intelligent designers.
Yeah, so if these cranes, if these advances, building on advances, can get us to this point. Is the same possible for computers?
Oh, it's possible. Absolutely, it's possible in principle. And in fact, what we're seeing now is that the new wave of artificial intelligence is actually reverting to sort of Darwinian roots, because the old-fashioned AI, which was top-down and rules and principles and get the sort of a deductive system, is being replaced by these very sort of hyper-empirical, sift through gazillion items of data, great mega databases, by what are basically thoughtless, mindless methods. This is competence without comprehension, but it turns out to be very, very competent. It can do things that we can't do the other way, the intelligent design way. As Francis Crick once said, evolution is cleverer than you are.
But as yet, it hasn't produced any kind of intelligence that we could have a beer with.
No, it's produced intelligent tools, but not colleagues.
And what's the difference there? Why is that?
Well, the difference is that a tool is much, much easier to make than a colleague. and a tool which will give you a lot of answers to a lot of questions is much easier to make than a colleague. How much easier? Well, let's take the example of IBM's Watson, which is as smart a tool as there is on the planet. It beat the world champion players of the quiz show Jeopardy, and it responded in natural language to questions posed in natural language. Pretty impressive. But what would it take to turn Watson into, you know, somebody worth befriending? How much bigger would Watson have to be? I think, you know, in the order of a million times bigger. And Watson already uses up the power of a small city. We're just scratching the surface of what you'd have to put in to make a colleague. We're not going to have artificial colleagues in the foreseeable future. We're going to have smart tools.
Reading From Bacteria to Bach and back, it feels like a summation of your life's work. Is that how it feels to you?
In many ways, yes. I hope I have a lot more life to go. But there is a sense in which I think, you know, I finally got together a pretty presentable account. And what I think is true, and I find readers that share this view, is now they see how the pieces go together and that they really do go together. And that there's a certain persuasiveness and strength in seeing the whole picture out there because all those, but what about X and what about Y, they're dealt with now. Not all of them, but most of them.
Daniel Dennett talking to Richard Lee. From Bacteria to Bach and Back, The Evolution of Minds is published by Alan Lane. Next week, we'll be at the London Book Fair. Plus, we'll be interviewing a debut novelist who we're convinced is destined for great things. She's called Ayobami Adebayo. She's from Nigeria, and her debut, Stay With Me, is an extraordinary account of the cost of infertility to a family.
In the meantime, you might want to check out another of The Guardian's podcasts, Token. It's about marginalised identities, but in a fun way. It asks questions like, is it okay to be a little bit racist? And enthuses on subjects such as the wonder of vulvas. To listen, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.
And for more literary interviews, discussions and live events, search for Guardian Books Podcast. You can find us at theguardian.com, on iTunes, on SoundCloud, or by swiping and tapping on your smartphone. Just open up your favourite podcast app. And you can join the conversation too, either by commenting on the Guardian website or at Guardian Books on Twitter. But for now, thanks to Daniel Dennett and Robert McCrum, from Sian, Richard and me, Claire Armitstead, not forgetting our indefatigable producer, Susanna Trezillian, goodbye and thanks for listening. And here's a little bit more from Audible of Tom Hollander reading from the start of A Clockwork Orange to spook you into the rest of your day.
What's it going to be then, eh? There was me, that is Alex, and my three droogs, that is Pete, Georgie and Dim, Dim being really dim. And we sat in the Corova milk bar making up our Razadox what to do with the evening, a flip, dark, chill winter bastard, though dry. The Corova milk bar was a milk plus mesto, and you may, oh my brothers, have forgotten what these mestos were like, things changing so scorry these days, and everybody very quick to forget, newspapers not being read much neither. Well, what they sold there was milk plus something else. They had no license for selling liquor, but there was no law yet against prodding some of the new veskies which they used to put into the old Moloko, so you could peat it with Velocet or Synthmesk or Drencrom or one or two other veshies, which would give you a nice quiet horror show 15 minutes admiring Bog and all his holy angels and saints in your left shoe with lights bursting all over your mosque. Or you could peat milk with knives in it, as we used to say, and this would sharpen you up and make you ready for a bit of dirty 20-1. And that was what we were peating this evening I'm starting off the story with. Our pockets were full of deng, so there was no real need from the point of view of cresting any more Pretty Polly to toll-chock some old vec in an alley and viddy him swim in his blood while we counted the takings and divided by four, nor to do the ultraviolet on some shivering, starry, grey-haired petitzer in a shop and go smecking off with the till's guts. But, as they say, money isn't everything. The four of us were dressed in the height of fashion, which in those days was a pair of black, very tight tights with the old jelly mould, as we called it, fitting on the crutch underneath the tights, this being to protect and also a sort of design you could viddy clear enough in a certain light so that I had one in the shape of a spider, Pete had a rooker, a hand that is, Georgie had a very fancy one of a flower, and poor old Dim had a very hound and horny one of a clown's litso face, that is, Dim not ever having much of an idea of things and being, beyond all shadow of a doubting Thomas, the dimmest of we four. Then we wore waisty jackets without lapels but with these very big built-up shoulders, plechos we called them, which were a kind of a mockery of having real shoulders like that. Then, my brothers, we had these off-white cravats which looked like whipped-up kartoffel or spud with a sort of design made on it with a fork. We wore our hair not too long and we had flip horror show boots for kicking. What's it gonna be then, eh? There were three Dvotchkas sitting at the counter all together, but there were four of us Malchiks, and it was usually like one for all and all for one. These sharps were dressed in the height of fashion too, with purple and green and orange wigs on their gullivers, each one not costing less than 3 or 4 weeks of those sharps' wages, I should reckon, and make-up to match, rainbows round the glazies, that is, and the rot painted very wide. Then they had long black very straight dresses, and on the groody part of them they had little badges of like silver with different Malchiks' names on them, Joe and Mike and such like. These were supposed to be the names of different Malchiks they'd spatted with before they were 14. They kept looking our way, and I nearly felt like saying the three of us, out of the corner of my rot that is, should go off for a bit of pole and leave poor old Dim behind, because it would be just a matter of cupping Dim a demi-litre of white, but this time with a dollop of synth mesk in it, but that wouldn't really have been playing like the game. Dim was very, very ugly and like his name, but he was a horror show filthy fighter and very handy with the boot. What's it gonna be then, eh?
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.